Lecture 35, The 17th Century, Crisis and Transition.
In this lecture, we're moving into the last major part of the course. We've just emerged from the period of religious warfare, and we've seen tremendous change take place during that period. We're now going to be moving into the 17th century for the rest of the course, and we'll be seeing a number of major developments take place in that century. What I want to do in this lecture right now is to give a kind of broad overview of the whole 17th century and some of the trends we might be watching as we focus in on more detail in each one of these different areas that I'll be just touching on briefly today. So this is designed to be a kind of preparatory overview for the whole period of the 17th century. In the 17th century, Europe was emerging from a very tumultuous period of religious, social, and political chaos, I think you could say, brought on by the Reformation and the period of religious wars. And one might have expected the next century to be more of a calming down period, but in fact, that's not what happened. The 17th century did not see a slowdown in the pace of change or a reduction in social tensions. In fact, the 17th century was a period of crisis and transition. Now, in a real sense, the whole period covered by this course, the early modern period from 1348 to 1715 or about, in a real sense, this entire period is one of often violent transition from medieval Europe to the society of modern Europe, or at least early modern Europe. So really the whole course, that's one of the main themes for everything in the course. But the 17th century is a crucial point in that transition. You might say it's the heart of the transition that this whole course covers in a more general kind of way. And we're going to see in the 17th century some really significant change in almost every aspect of life that most Europeans experienced. For example, in politics, we will see the rise of the modern military bureaucratic state, in particular on the continent, the rise of royal absolutism. And of course, we'll take a much longer look at this later on in later lectures, but we're talking about Louis XIV, the growth of French royal power, the growth of absolutism in Germany as well, and in other countries, which really is the beginning of the modern state. The old monarchy that was a partnership of king and nobles in the Middle Ages, long gone. Even new monarchy has now been surpassed, and we're going into a period in which the king, in most countries, has truly absolute power. Because of that, most local autonomy is destroyed in the various countries, and there's a far-reaching power of the state bureaucracy and the state military, which affects people's lives. So we'll really begin to see the growth of the modern state structure in the 17th century. Of course, there are several different models for that. Royal absolutism in France and Germany is not the only model. We will also see the growth of limited monarchy in England. We will see the maturation of the Dutch Republic. And we'll also see the virtual collapse of the Spanish monarchy. So we'll see a lot of different examples of political development in the 17th century, but probably the most significant is the growth of royal absolutism. In terms of intellectual life, we'll be seeing the scientific revolution and the rise of modern science, which will completely change the traditional religious worldview that most Europeans have had for this entire period. The old worldview based on the teachings of Aristotle and the Bible will be replaced by the rise of modern empirical science and the use of reason. This will lead us directly into the birth of the early Enlightenment and the rational secular worldview of the Enlightenment, which really is the beginnings of the modern European worldview and the way that Europeans think about things in the modern world. So that's pretty significant intellectual change there. Economically, the 17th century is a period of real crisis. But because it's a period of crisis, it's also a period of change and a period of restructuring. We'll see in the beginning of the 17th century, economic prosperity in the 16th century dropping off into a period of economic stagnation for about half the century, and then real depression at the end of the century. The first major depression in the European economy since the days of the bubonic plague. But this depression will bring about really important changes and restructuring in the economy that will prepare the way for the later growth of the industrial economy in Europe, which will occur in the last part of the 18th century. So economically speaking, in this course, we won't see the birth of the industrial revolution or industrial society, but we will see significant changes in the agrarian economy and market structure of Europe, which will set the stage, and I would argue were an essential preliminary development for later on the growth of the industrial economy. And just in general in the 17th century, we will see a speeding pace of change all over. And this speeding pace of change, whether it be in political life or intellectual life or economic life, it produces crisis. It produces a good deal of social dislocation. It produces political turmoil, wars, revolts, as we'll see. And it produces a good deal of economic disruption. And one of the things that we need to think about as we review this kind of broad picture of the 17th century, of course, transition comes and transition is necessary, but must it entail crisis? Is transition, is change always the product of crisis and difficulty, or can it happen in other ways? We might have a chance to think about that towards the end of the lecture. There has been a long-running debate among historians having to do with the 17th century and just debating whether and to what extent the 17th century was a period of crisis. And I just thought I would review a couple of the main positions that historians have taken. The English historian Eric Hobsbawm sees the 17th century as a period of mainly economic crisis. He sees the agricultural and commercial recession, which comes out of the period of stagnation. He sees wealth becoming concentrated in the hands of the upper classes, mainly nobles. The impoverishment of the lower classes, so a kind of growing gap, rich and poor. But he sees this concentration of wealth in a few or a limited number of hands as productive later on of capital investments which are needed for the growth of industry, which will take place, of course, at a later period. So economic transition in the 17th century from a feudal agrarian economy to one that's preparing the way for industrial growth. Another English historian, Hugh Trevor Roper, sees the century as mainly one of political crisis, and he points to all the many wars and revolts that we'll see in the 17th century, the Fronde rebellion of nobles in France, the English Civil War, the 30 Years' War we've already seen, revolts in Spain and other countries. And he says that these wars and revolts are all caused by a common struggle of court versus country, of king versus people. The growing size and power of royal courts and royal governments being resented by the great mass of population in most countries, particularly because they bear the tax burden from it. And he sees the struggle of court versus country settled in different ways in different places. In France, where absolutism is born, the king wins, the royal government wins. But in Britain, where limited monarchy is born, the people and parliament win. So different results in different places. And there are other historians who just doubt that there was a tremendous crisis in the century at all. John Eliot says that the political crisis wasn't very significant, and Ivo Scheffer denies there was much of an economic crisis. So there are many different ways you can look at it. What I would like to argue in the time we have left in this lecture is that there was a crisis in the 17th century, and it was a general crisis, sweeping across all areas of life, economic, political, intellectual, just about every measure you can think of. And that this crisis was an outward symptom of underlying change, underlying currents of change in society, which are very important. So we'll start out. Well, we'll actually continue by taking a look at two or three of the principal areas of crisis and change in the 17th century, from my point of view. First of all, the economic crisis, because there's a great deal of economic restructuring in the 17th century. And we start out with population. European population has been growing since about 1460. That population growth largely stops in the 17th century. First we have stagnation and later decline. But it doesn't stop at the same place or the same time in all places. And this is important. Population growth stops first in the southern parts of Europe, then later on in the north. And what that means is there's a shift of population overall from south to north in Europe. And this shift in population is going to have important economic consequences. We're going to actually see a shift in economic power from south, the old centers, Italy, to north, the new centers, Britain, the Netherlands. In terms of population, Italy and parts of Germany lose population. France stays about the same, pretty stagnant. England and Holland both gain population. The reason for the population declines are many. The 30 Years' War and the deaths related to that, famine due to the economic disruptions, overpopulation, bad weather. There are many different causes for it. The 17th century also sees a pretty major depression in the agricultural realm, and this is brought along by the population stagnation and then decline, because population decline means a drop in demand for food. This is very similar to what we saw in the 14th century, in fact. Fall in demand means a fall of farm prices and a fall of farm profits, and we see this happening from about 1630 on. Even grain imports into Europe decline, and so starvation increases. Industrially speaking, there's also an economic depression. It hits the wool and cloth industry, which is the major sector of the major part of the industrial sector, but not everywhere equally. The wool and cloth industry of France, Spain, and Italy are pretty hard hit. But on the other hand, the wool and cloth industry of England and Holland do fairly well, in fact, tend to prosper. And so what we see here again is a shift. We see a shift in industrial resources, a shift in industrial profits, and a shift in industrial activity from the south to the north. And these south-north shifts are very important because up until now in this course, southern Europe has been economically, socially, and in many ways politically dominant, and we're going to see a change in that situation, and there's going to be a lot more importance put on northern Europe economically and politically. Similar trends in international trade can be noticed. For example, the international trade of such countries as the Dutch and English prosper, whereas the international trade of the Italian and Spanish declines somewhat. And so once again, there's a shift to the north in profits made in the commercial sector. Well, the results of these kinds of population and economic shifts will inevitably be political shifts and shifts of political power. Because one of the things that's a constant in European history is that political power and military power pretty much follow industrial, economic, and agricultural development. So the shift north in one area will cause us to see a shift north in other areas as well. And this will produce a crisis in the south, which is losing resources, but not necessarily a crisis in the north, which is gaining resources. One economic sector in the 17th century seems to be expanding everywhere in Europe, and this is closely related to political developments in the century. This is the sector known as the public sector, or state spending. That seems to be on the increase in every country, even south, north, east, and west. Governments are becoming bigger and bigger spenders. They're becoming bigger and bigger buyers of commodities and more important economic players. This has the effect, well, it has a mixed effect on the overall economy. And anytime you look at the relationship between the public sector and the larger economy, you're going to get a very complicated picture. Because government spending will tend to stimulate some sectors, but it will tend to depress other sectors. And then it's a little bit hard to work out whether overall it's beneficial or not beneficial to the economy. Among sectors that government spending will stimulate, of course, are the arms industry, shipbuilding, things like that. which are involved in military operations, munitions, all that will be expanded. But one of the results of the expansion of state spending we're going to see is an increase in warfare and an increase in taxation to pay for warfare. And an increase in taxation and warfare actually has a negative effect on the economy in most countries and will act to create economic stagnation and or depression. Here in the 17th century, the real culprit to all this is the growing power of kings, the growing royal power in most countries. Growing royal power, growing power of governments in general, produces more competition between states. And more competition between states inevitably produces more warfare. More warfare means increased taxation. And this increased tax burden tends to fall primarily on the agrarian economy, because the agrarian sector is, as we'll see in the next lecture, by far the largest sector of the economy. And it employs by far the most people. It uses by far the greatest resources in the economy. It is the major economic sector. And that's where the tax burden is going to fall. And it's going to fall on the people least able to pay, the peasant workers in the agrarian economy. It's true also that the tax burden in this period will fall on the middle class, and a good part of the middle class is much more able to pay than the peasants. However, the peasantry is just such a bigger proportion of total population that the tax burden falling on that sector will inevitably be larger than the tax burden falling on other areas. And because the peasants can't pay or have a very, very difficult time paying, this increased tax burden will lead to peasant revolts. Now, in European history, peasant revolts are nothing at all new. There were many in the Middle Ages, numerous in the 14th century, the English peasant revolt, the Jacquerie in France, and then, of course, the famous peasant war in Germany that we saw in 1525. But the 17th century actually has probably more peasant revolts than most other centuries in European history, and the growing tax burden is probably the major reason for that. The increased taxes means starvation for peasants, essentially. These peasants already living right at the subsistence level. A lot of these economic changes point out the financial burden of the growth of the modern state, and this is a major factor in the 17th century. And the financial burden caused by the growth of the modern state leads to certain things that you might not necessarily expect, and the things that we'll take a look at just briefly before we end this lecture. The growth of the modern state, the growth of absolutism, will lead to population decline in many countries and will lead to actual economic depression in many countries, which, of course, creates a kind of vicious cycle because the growing state needs more money. The money must come from taxes. Taxes are produced by the economy. If the economy is depressed, the taxes won't be sufficient. The income for the state won't be sufficient. And it produces a kind of circular problem. A lot of money going to the state in taxes simply means that people have less money to spend. They can't buy food, they can't buy manufactured goods, which means there's no demand for manufacturers, which means the industrial sector shrinks, and there's a great deal of starvation. So economically and socially speaking, it's a very difficult century, but it really is related to political change. And I would argue here that political change is the most significant kind of change, or the most far-reaching kind that we see developing in the 17th century. Now, we've already seen several stages in the development of European monarchy. We've seen the medieval monarchy, which was a partnership of king and nobles. That falls apart in the 14th century. Then we saw a new monarchy, where powerful new kings come onto the throne, start replacing nobles with middle-class people in office and government, build up the bureaucracy, increase the taxes, and they're headed towards a much stronger government. But then the religious wars intervene. The religious wars seriously hurt monarchies in many countries. I mean, France is perhaps the best or worst example, but in other countries as well, religious war really sets monarchy back. And so the 17th century is again a period of rebuilding the power of monarchy and the power of the state. And this time it becomes a rebuilding that doesn't really turn back. It's a constant, maintained, sustained building that will lead to the modern military bureaucratic state. And during this period, state authority is going to be extended to every area of every country, to every group of people in every society. It's going to become much more like what we're used to today in terms of state structure. The size and power of the state bureaucracy will grow everywhere in the 17th century. And this extends control of the king over all the different areas of his country. In earlier days, there might be many quite far-removed provinces, far away from the capital, which saw very little influence of the central government. And this is no longer going to be the case as the government bureaucracy grows and reaches out to all areas. Also, as the government bureaucracy grows, it's going to reach out to all social classes. There'll be no one who's exempt from the interference of the government and government demands. Not just demands for taxation, although that's the major one, but demands for military service, demands for loans in the case of the financial markets, all sorts of demands for information, demands for services that governments didn't used to place upon some groups in society. In particular, the nobility has for many years been rather unbothered by the demands of the state. But this is no longer going to be the case in the 17th century. So governments start to extend their power over all sectors of society and all regions of the country, and it really becomes a very vast bureaucratic mechanism. And the one simple reason for this growth is the collection of taxes. And the one reason for the collection of taxes is the fighting of wars. And the reason for wars is the competition among states. So it's really, it's a whole chain of causation that's put in place and rather hard to move and rather hard to change. This growth in government, bureaucracy, and influence has a lot of disruptive effects in various countries across Europe. It really disrupts traditional society in major ways. For example, customary laws start to be ignored. Kings adopt their own legal systems. They're trying still very hard to adopt a Roman law. They're trying to ignore the customary oral traditional law of different parts of their countries. A country like France, for example, at one time had many different laws for different areas and different social groups. And now the trend is towards uniformity, one legal code for the whole country. And to enforce that, of course, what you have to do is you have to remove the other laws, the other traditional customary law codes that people have always followed. And this is a very unpopular and disruptive thing to do, but it's going to be attempted almost everywhere and done in many places. And it's almost essential for the growth of the modern state to have this kind of legal uniformity. Local autonomy is going to be disrupted in a big way, taken away virtually. And where people used to have a good deal of local independence, they're not going to have that anymore. Whereas villages used to be able to elect their own mayors, they won't have that. They'll have appointed mayors. A lot of local independence will simply be ignored or canceled or overwhelmed by the growth of government. Traditional rights will be superseded. In traditional Europe, different social classes had their own specific sets of rights and privileges that other social classes didn't have. Nobles had certain rights, like to bear arms and wear fur, that peasants and the lower classes didn't have. There will be, in the 17th century, a movement to iron out this situation and create a set of rights or privileges common to everybody. All social classes, very, very difficult to do. And here the major obstacle is going to be the overcoming of noble privilege, which is throughout the 17th century and even in the 18th century, a cause of major political disruption. And finally, tax exemptions are going to be ignored. In the traditional European society up to this point, tax exemptions were given out for various reasons, to sometimes to entire cities, sometimes to social groups, sometimes to a family, to just for various different reasons to various different entities in society. Now, because of the need for tax money, these exemptions are going to be ignored. And people are going to come forward and they're going to say, well, now we've never paid taxes. Why do we have to pay taxes now? And the state doesn't really have an answer for that question except for the fact that it needs taxation. And, you know, people will say, I have a right not to be taxed. I have this privilege not to be taxed. And governments will simply ignore it and use force to nullify complaints based on previous privileges and exemptions. Well, as you can imagine, these trends in the growth of the modern state displease a lot of people. And I'm not just talking about peasants. Certainly, peasants are very upset by the curtailment of their rights and their autonomy and what little wealth they might have had. But not just peasants. At the top of society, nobles are equally angered by the movement towards a stronger state. And even in the middle class, which tends to be allied with the king more often than not, and which tends to profit from the growth of the modern state more than other social groups, even the middle class will have problems and will have complaints with this dynamic process, because it is a process of such tremendous change. And change always elicits opposition. So throughout the 17th century, we will see revolts and rebellions. We will see peasant revolts in France, many of them in the 17th century, but other countries as well. But there'll also be rebellions of nobles. For example, the famous Fronde in France, which sets the stage for the rule of Louis XIV. But there'll be noble rebellions in other countries. There will be a major political movement on the part of nobles in various countries to hold on to their rights and powers, and not see these rights and powers essentially transferred down the social scale to the middle class, because the middle class has become the king's ally in the growth of the modern state. So we see social tensions getting worse between different groups in society and between the different groups and the state and the king. This is part of the court versus country argument that we saw made by an earlier historian. And I should point out that the revolts of peasants and nobles against the growth of the state, these are essentially conservative revolts, conservative revolutions. They're saying, we just want to keep it the way it used to be. We just don't want to have it change like this. We don't think the state has the right to change like this. We don't think the state has the right to grow like this. So the rebellions are not introducing anything new. It's the state introducing something new. And I would argue that the single most important thing in the 17th century is that the growth of the modern state, the military bureaucratic state, is itself a political revolution. And it is bringing about political conditions that have never existed before, and that the rest of society now has to deal with, and they find it very difficult to deal with it. And we've already seen earlier in this lecture that the growth of the modern state has serious economic implications for different social classes. It's a serious burden on the overall economy. It will affect intellectual life in ways such as with the disputes over Roman law versus traditional customary law. It'll have far-reaching effects in terms of tax burden, bureaucratic expansion, and bureaucratic irritation to people, war, which becomes increasingly destructive, and it will affect the whole level of population. So I think the end conclusion to this discussion of 17th century crisis has to be that the growth of the modern state is at the root of a huge amount of other change, which takes the shape of social, economic, and often political crisis. And what we should consider as we move through the 17th century is, could this kind of change have been effected without such disruption, without such a crisis, without such dramatic change, and without the state basically running over people's rights and just basically ignoring people's social positions, as often we'll see happen. So that's kind of the basic blueprint for what's going to happen in the 17th century. In future lectures, we'll be looking at the political changes, we'll be looking at the intellectual changes, and in the very next lecture, we'll look at some of the economic restructuring.